Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet John Stupp. John Stupp is the author of the 2007 Main Street Rag chapbook, The Blue Pacific, and the 2015 full-length collection, Advice from the Bed of a Friend, also by Main Street Rag. Recent poetry has appeared in the Timberline Review, The New Guard, The Mackinac, Long Dumb Voices, and Fried Chicken and Coffee. John holds degrees from Notre Dame, the University of British Columbia, and Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. He has lived and worked in various states as a jazz musician, university instructor, taxi driver, radio news writer, waiter, auto factory laborer, and paralegal. Hi, John. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, that's a long list of things, and I'm sure that really helps your poetry.
I've exaggerated it to make myself sound great.
Oh, okay. Well, good. Okay. So you're going to start with some poems from Advice from the Bed of a Friend.
Sure. I'd like to read a couple that started out west when I lived in Idaho for a few years. And the first one is called First Cold Night of Autumn. In the mountains, trees practice for winter, dropping their leaves. Birds like thin farmhands sweep down on rutted back roads begging for food. I'm driving north to Montana in a 68 Buick with a heater that doesn't work, past fields that slip away in the mist, crusted over with the heapage of summer. Soon the sun will burn frost smoke clear as ice. Snow will come as white cloth, bandaging hills with silence. Trees will be smooth again. Tonight, villages huddle along the road for warmth. Their half-open gates, rusted cold until next year, cry out in the night wind, then they give up and sleep. Only smoke from a cog railroad makes petals in the air over the Rockies, a flower garden to open somewhere after a deepening Christmas. When I was young, I really liked the poetry of James Wright, and this is a poem kind of I would dedicate to him in his memory. This is called Prayer in Time of Loneliness. Mountains in southern Idaho are silent, waiting for trees to speak, so rivers flow at night when no one can hear them. Lone automobiles crossing the desert throw their light across the cities of the West. Far from water, people hold up their hands. They sleep in bus terminals and work camps in fear of poetry. I have seen in the deepest part of the country, along a nameless back road, the tired eyes of a farmer whose cattle have not come in from a storm. He is looking into a terrible drunken world, waiting to drown in a hailstorm of bad luck. At night, he will take a shotgun and go out to avenge himself on a jackpine. Lord, it is better to be alone than to know the secret dreams of men. Grant us peace. I'm going to move along with some poems that kind of relate to my working life in Pittsburgh. And the first one is called Excuses. I had to walk around my building for a minute. Check the air, sky, the sun, clouds. The wind was a blade against my forehead. I'm thinking of honeydew melons, stepping naked in sweet soil, wet vines on a tangled horizon. Crackheads are nodding off outside, bumping into pedestrians, muttering, out of the way. Pretty soon my boss will wonder where I am. What if I give 2 weeks' notice and go to Brazil, where the rainforests are turning into dungholes, and start a melon farm, far away from anywhere, in the last bit of woods? At sunset, I'll watch rain approaching far off, blown in like a wedding veil, drops raising dust on soft rinds. Then inside, cool sheets, sound of night bugs chirping, my wife in my mouth. This poem is entitled, The Sun Was Shining. I was sitting at my desk reading the deposition of an embezzler, and the sun was shining outside over the tops of buildings. And I saw lovers having lunch in a park with no thought of the wrinkled hills God piled near this river, the shaken pumice falling by chance in a storm from heaven, the bus-beaten roads aimed like a spear point at the city. Why should lovers have to explain such things, I thought, Someday the empty coffin of their hearts will be dead as a wrecked pickup with no floorboard. Like a dust-blown okie on the road to California before the farm goes dark. The cracked windshield wide as the sky's eyelid. And someday the embezzler will be in prison, his mind vibrating like a broken telescope behind the alarm wire. But as I said before, pistons were broiling in the heat. Cars choking. Bridges rocking with hurt. Excavators, cranes, conveyor belts were idle, and the sun was shining, bright as a stripper's fingernail against the far bank of hell.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet John Stupp. He's reading from his new book, Advice from the Bed of a Friend. It's published by Main Street Rag. John, I wanted to ask you about writing from experience. You have a lot of it, it seems like. In your bio, you know, you talk about going to three universities and then all of this work experience, a lot of it, you know, working class stuff, as in taxi driver, waiter. And, you know, when I listen to your work, I feel a lot of class issues in there, working class stuff. I don't know if you... how you negotiate those worlds when you sit down to write.
I guess I'm thinking of my experience for sure. And after 8 years in a row at university, I left to play music, and I kind of joined the real world, I felt. This would have been about 1975. And I started then a string of jobs while I was playing music, basically to support myself while playing music. Taxi driver. I taught at Boise State in the English department, freshman English courses, things like that. Was a news writer at an FM channel out west. Coming back here then, I met Betty, my wife, in a nightclub when I was playing music in Pittsburgh. And once we started living together, I realized I needed a legitimate job outside of music that provided health insurance and everything. We wanted to have kids and stuff. So I got a job as a paralegal, and that's what I've done ever since. So I guess I'm navigating a couple worlds, off and on, but both of them provide inspiration. I mean, the work poems in Pittsburgh from an office perspective kind of, but also the other poems. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of looking at that, and I'm kind of looking kind of from the jazz idea that I want the poems to have a good beginning like a jazz solo does. I want them to have long lines like the great jazz players do, like I always tried to do. And I want them to have an explosion in there somewhere. And that's sort of what I'm trying. So it doesn't always work, but that's where I'm heading.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really admire the sense of the plain spoken that comes through in your poems. I mean, you obviously have a lot of image and a lot of great language, but there's this sense of plain spokenness that comes through. And when you talked about liking James Wright early on, I mean, there's that quote from him, something like, all I can do is speak in a flat voice, something like that. And I wonder if you feel committed to that plain spoken voice, or is that what comes?
I think it comes, and I think I've always liked him. I've liked William Stafford. Mm-hmm. I've liked Philip Levine, people who are coming at it from that, whose voices seem to have that element in them. By the same token, though, I've always enjoyed John Ashbery because the lines are so beautiful. And when I think of the years I spent with a guitar with horns in front of me rising and falling in those jazz lines, I mean, I look at his poetry and I say, boy, that's what's happening there. I sometimes don't understand it, but those beautiful lines, almost beauty for its own sake, which I kind of find also attractive. And I try to incorporate that in with the plain side of myself too, if I can do that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm looking at that side, and the Wallace Stevens Ashbery side, and I'm looking at the other guys too.
Okay.
It's all good.
Could you read some more?
Sure. This one's called Friday Night. You can tell I get a lot of inspiration riding the bus back and forth to work. After work, it rained and thundered. So birds huddled on rooftops and hot gutters like copper coins dropping from the pockets of the poor. heads bobbing, damp sparks almost smiling at the wet fury. While the tiresome news of a world gone to hell played on, pumped again from shop windows in the drowned city, helpless like the notes of a pipe organ, peeled open by God. Wave after wave of spray bristled on the pavement's edge until the worthless moon appeared. Umbrellas and raincoats blossomed in this catastrophe. Then it was over. Clouds moved off quickly to the east. Sky scrubbed clean as a martini, air soft as cork. Mud ripening, car windows down, radios booming. I was on my way home again for the millionth time in the unmapped dark, washed up like a chorus girl on this chattering shore. Want to read one that's got a little Pittsburgh background here. This is based on the Pirates of 1960. I wasn't in Pittsburgh then. I was in Cleveland, but I remember listening to it on a transistor radio, one of those old electronic devices. This is what Ralph Terry said. If he'd lived to be 1,000, he'd never escape the prop wash from Mazeroski's drive. A churning wake, blown like a nail through his heart and his children and his children's children. Ralph, wake up. Everything is okay. A carnival with friendly equipment. Families, lawns, sidewalks, radios, lived in, used. But then, the sound of a ball meeting wood, two rocks snapping, cold chisel on a steel chain, shovel against a locked closet. Every afternoon, the crack in the split sky widens as a sick noise goes blue overhead, glove hand covering your face. Can I run the newsreel back 1,000,000 times in slow motion to find the exact spot where every stranger starts to ask, "Aren't you?" for the rest of your life? This one's called My Death. And I was thinking of Merwin's poem about the anniversary of my death. I think is the name of his poem, where he talks about we know our birthday because we pass it every year, but we also have an anniversary of our death. We don't know what day that is. And so I was kind of thinking about that, and then I kind of went off the track here. My death. After hours, when I celebrate my death, dancing in my house in the dark, the world can go to hell, and all the lawyers, politicians, and junkies can hose themselves with machine gun fire on Geraldo, if they so choose, and I won't care. And I won't care if some Old Testament prophet dressed in women's underwear says these are the last times before the conflagration, before the apocalypse, before the drinking jag of the last judgment, and I won't care if Jesus comes down with a flamethrower to prune the vineyards of New York and Philadelphia and Los Angeles. And I won't care if there is a crimson cloud filled with a bonfire of the world's vermin seen for hundreds of miles in the air, or if ashes floating skyward form a never-ending mantra on death's prayer wheel. I won't care. And I won't care if Christ in his hip boots comes and says my life has been evil, because he might, and because I have been a liar and a thief. And I won't care if I am drunk and roaming my house in the dark, naked as a corpuscle from one beating chamber to another, like a child, because no man's army can stop my helicopter heart from hammering the air with harder sounds. I'll play a loud chaconne and dance into the ground. And God will say it is good, and he will bless me and forgive my sins. And I will move downward great distances into darkness where things are simpler.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet John Stupp. And he's reading from his new book, Advice from the Bed of a Friend, published by Main Street Rag. And I was just listening to that last poem and, you know, thinking of poems I want to write, which is always good when, you know how that goes when you hear a poet and you think, oh. And I was wondering why I never used the word corpuscle in my poems. It's such a good word.
I don't know how I came up with that.
Why didn't I do that? Really nice poem. And In the last couple poems that you've read, all I can think of is voice, you know, how well you use voice and how important it is in your work. But before I go anywhere, I want to say that, you know, when you said I wasn't in Pittsburgh when the Pittsburgh Pirates won the 1960 World Series, I was in Cleveland. That's how right. Blasphemous that is.
It is.
Okay.
My wife reminds me of my Cleveland background at every occasion.
But that sentence was disturbing. Okay. Okay. So back to voice. You know, I really found myself getting lost in a good way in the last couple of poems, in the Pirates poem and in the anniversary, in my death poem. And I think those were a little longer poems. And they're both in your new book, is that correct?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
I think I was getting, trying to hear a kind of almost a sing-song repetition kind of thing that seemed to kind of take over me in some of those poems too, and that I kind of went with it, you know, to see where it would end up, especially in my death.
You seem to be good at minimizing your accomplishments, because so far you've said, I'm a liar, I'm a thief, I've exaggerated my bio, and I have a sing-song rhythm in my poems. So I think...
There's so many great poets out there, though. I mean, so many good ones.
I know, but...
And musicians, so many good ones. Yeah, you spend your life to try to at least reach a level of competence, to be average. That's what I was hoping to be.
Well,
use that as a springboard, then.
Well, I think we want to. I'm trying to say how good these poems are.
Thank you very much.
You're working against me, but no, I want to talk about a sense of location that I feel in your poems, and often you'll say it before the poems. I mean, we've had Idaho poems, Pittsburgh poems, I wonder how, if place is a so a way you find poems, if you start with place sometimes.
I think that's right, for sure. I mean, I've been a lot of places. I've been in Pittsburgh steady now for the last, since late 1970s when I came here. But I do think back on the places that I've been and do that kind of mental traveling that sort of sets me in those situations, and the poems seem to flow from that.
Mm-hmm.
The newer poems I have about fishing and all that are usually set in the Carolinas. Uh-huh. And if I start to drift there, if I'm daydreaming at work and I start to drift there, the poems seem to flow from that. There seems to be less effort than in setting up a poem or starting one, let's say.
Mm-hmm. And before we started the interview, you were talking about your fishing poems and how they were working well. So... And people really responded to them.
They have been, for sure, yeah.
So could you read a couple of those?
Sure.
Okay.
This is a poem entitled Pauly's Island, and it's appearing in the Mackinac, an online journal. I cast out, and my line went slack in the current. A black drum swam towards me with a message that the osprey and the live oak was still asleep, as were the sea oats and crabs. And what was I doing interrupting the morning before coffee and shrimp? I let him go in the running water of his estate. We both wept. A cloud took up half the sky, and it wasn't a symbol for anything. This poem is called Another Poem About Fishing, and it is also in the online magazine Houseguest. Online journal, I should say. My wife is pulling spots into our boat faster than I can bait lines. Her rod bends in the shallow water. A quick glimmer in the tide's circle, and these fish want us to eat them in pancake batter, per the local custom, not like some stranger. My wife is a good fisherman. Oh, boy, she can really catch them. This is another poem set in South Carolina again, for Robert. It's heaven to fish all morning on Garden City's pier, built after Hugo, with a line screwed in the seabed crust, white as a vein in the air's wet skin, blood barely beating in the mind. Above, God's sky, a swept chimney roasting our wooden deck like a southern truck. Below, The Atlantic foams at the piling base like a dark toad. Wave tops curl their rubbery vertebrae and press droplets forward until they burst into daylight, popping like glass targets on the shore's breezy range. Under the pier, water shards are tossed off like firecrackers of repeating color at worshiping plankton locked in cataracts of spray. Seabirds, watching this fantail from the edge of the wind, scull the motionless sky as if in prayer. Gulls, pelicans, all balancing, nonchalant airmen, too proud to fly near the sun's exploding sacrament until dusk. When? No wings are known save these. No dreams are known save these, but the hard horizon altered by the sea.
John, I want to go back to something you said earlier about jazz and movement in your poems. And you said that you like to have an explosion in your poems. And in poetry terms, I mean, are you talking about a turn in the poem, or are you talking about something
I'm talking about something that jumps out, that sometimes it's at the end. It's often at the end, but sometimes it might be in the middle of the poem and the end kind of drops from it. I'm kind of almost thinking of a visual, looking at the poem as if it's a graph, kind of in a way, and, or if it's a line of notes on a staff, that there's some kind of twist, some kind of surprise somewhere. I'm looking to try to create that. The poems that I've admired have that in them, usually. So I'm sort of saying, if that's how a good poet writes, I want to try that. I want to do that. If that's how a good jazz musician constructs a solo, then I want to do that too. Looking at it like an apprentice looks at a craft, kind of in a way. So I'm thinking of it that way.
And that would be something that you might push the poem to when you're revising, or
sure, it would come up. It might not be there at the beginning, let's say, or when I'm first thinking of it, or it might, for example, I have a poem right here that I found a line that I loved and I wanted to use it. It was a line from one of Ashbery's poems. I'm not sure which one now. I can't remember, but it turns out to be the last line of this poem. So I wrote the poem backwards, and that was sort of almost like beginning with an explosion and recreating, rewinding back in a kind of a way.
What do you mean you wrote the poem backwards?
Well, I sort of had the last line first.
His line.
Yeah.
And then, okay. Well, why don't you read it and we can listen.
Sure. Okay. This is called Sunday Morning. And thinking of John Ashbery with this one. On this clear morning, this calm morning after a new moon, after a night where every husband in Zihuatanejo has been satisfied by whores, after a night where the impotent priests are fasting in the Catholic churches and praying that God will destroy the world little by little, and pound the dead land with his wet hammer, and pound the breakwall where the fishermen stand like sure-footed children in the rippling swells. The impotent priests are praying that God will rip the bait nets and scatter fish in the noisy spray, and that God will drive the blessed boats onto pilings until the nailheads sing like the metal brains of 1,000 radios splattering in the surf. I am a fisherman, praying that God the Destroyer will not find me, trolling out beyond the breakwall, where the deep water covers the heart of the world and its great artery beating beneath the waves. I am praying God will not find me beyond the breakwall where the watery mountains are filled with the babble of drowned souls going to hell on this, the clearest morning, the calmest morning in the history of the sea, in the history of drunkenness, as the sun comes up in a rainbow of tears.
So that line...
the sun comes up in a rainbow of tears. I remember reading that in one of his poems, and I thought, oh, boy, that's great. Well, I got to steal that. That's awesome.
Oh, okay. I was thinking that it was on this clear morning, and I'm like, well, that's not so amazing. I was like, okay, all right.
You know, you hear those great lines. You hear Charlie Parker playing something, and you think, oh, I got to play that. I got to figure that.
Yeah.
I got to work a variation on that.
Okay.
So that's what I was thinking.
Okay.
This poem is called Lightning Over Chestnut Ridge. And it's talking about my family when we were camping one time. The neon force of bolts is amazing, stapling the ground bright as a rubber shade, the wind, rain, sucking the sky's alporn. Around us, stones crack at the root, granite splintering off to heap up higher in West Virginia like old molars. Then it is over. Stars parachute through the ashes where a fire had been. In our tent, the littlest one is snoring like a saw blade, steam from her breath rising in the dark behind our eyes. This poem is, again, my kids figure in this one, and I'm taking the title of one of Ashbery's poems, a picture of little J.A. in a prospect of flowers, and I'm twisting it to say picture of little R and K in a prospect of flowers. It won't work in real life, so I imagine a mind's eyesight unobstructed by sun and calm before the abyss. Then Spig's vineyard, a file of trees fixed beyond his rabbit pen where cicadas call in the July heat like angels in the air's rigging. While his old plows sail westward in the weeds of that eternal afternoon. Then an old Kodak with two browned faces unbridled by a summer of no consequence in the ripe garden where Midge's flowers and vegetables, now occupied by others, were gripped by love. So, like everyone else, I want to touch the dumb mouths of these shadows, the silent film strip that bears a name misspelled, the petunias, zinnias, daylilies, the semper vivum, the coffee cans with slugs, the blueberry bushes. I want to talk to strangers in the apple orchard holding tomatoes, coming to me smiling. Time is all they own, who know where it starts and where it ends, who know the stars behind the sun are always shining and always burning until dark.
We have time for one more.
This one's for my little daughter, Kathleen, when she was 2. She's a young woman now. She's 27, soon to be 28. This is called Kathleen's Birthday. Little dancer, easy on your feet here. If music is a question, you're an answer. Spig's accordion, Polish polkas he plays on, a second celebration of age's contagion. Don't pause or bow, time steps in minutes somehow. Soon grown-ups and bedtime won't allow pirouetting now. Daughter, dancer, sleeping on my shoulder, if beauty is forever, you're no older.
The poetry of John Stupp. Thank you so much. That was great.
Thanks for having me. It was awesome. It's great.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.